Okay. Just maybe tell us your name and the date today.
This is David Parsons. It's May 17th, 2016, 22 years to the day since I showed up in Missoula to start my tenure as director of the Leopold Institute.
Great. Well, we appreciate you letting us interview you and keeping these files in Leopold Institute. I don't have a formal release for you to sign, but I assume it's okay that you've seen the questions I'm asking. And my first one was just ask if you had any early experiences in your life contributed to your interest in parks and nature generally.
Well, yes, I think a lot of my early life set me up for where I ended up. Growing up in an academic household where my father was a professor of geography at Berkeley, but he worked with and was friends with a number of just leading names in the conservation fields at the time. So I sort of was aware of who David Brower and Starker Leopold and people of that nature were, not just aware of them. They would come to our home, and I knew them. But also, maybe even more importantly, is we spent a lot of time as a family traveling. A lot of the time, tent camping, sometimes without a tent, just sleeping out under the stars and visiting places all across the country, but probably more in the West and in other countries. So I think I visited a lot of national parks when I was a kid. There wasn't designated wilderness at that time, of course, but in the 50s, very early 60s, I visited probably most of the big Western parks just on vacation type visits, and became really interested in parks and nature, and mostly the big parks, the natural parks.
What about research about those parks or about nature? Was that from some of these early people that visited in your family, or something happened in college, or where did the interest in research come?
No, when I started college at UC Davis, I really wasn't sure what I wanted to go into, but I ended up taking a general biology major, and I think the experience I had between my junior and senior years, where I had some money through a plant ecology professor at Davis to spend the summer in the Sierra Nevada, hiking, looking, trying to document where the southern distributions of mountain hemlock trees were. So I mostly by myself, but sometimes I had a friend or colleague from school go along with me. I did a lot of backpacking and started realizing, wow, you can combine science, some scientific questions, even though it wasn't a very heavy-duty question I was addressing, with my love of the outdoors. And then when it came time to go on to grad school, I'm not sure I would have gone if it wasn't. We weren't in the middle of the Vietnam War, and that was the easy way to stay out of the draft without having to make some other hard decisions. So I initially was accepted to go to Berkeley to study under Starker Leopold, and then I decided maybe that wasn't such a good idea to go study under a family friend. And I ended up at Stanford, not because that's a place I would have thought, or I thought about going because of where I ended up working in parks and wilderness type issues, but because, and I to this day, that's hardly a school you would think of as putting out people that go into that field. There have been very few, but I went there, decided to go there, because Paul Ehrlich was studying human population issues and impacts on the environment, and he, of course, was appearing on Johnny Carson late at night regularly. He had just published with his wife the book The Population Bomb, and I heard him give a couple of talks, and I thought, whoa, this is going to be really exciting. I got there and discovered that his grad students all studied technical issues about butterflies, and he spent almost no time with them. And so I switched into something that led me more down the direction of a broad ecological questions.
If you hadn't gone to graduate school, do you think you would have still gone in the nature management field, or do you have a
you know, as a kid,
I
always tested out that I should be a park ranger or a forest ranger. Okay. I for a while was intrigued by the nursery business and plants. So I don't know. I might have gone one of those directions rather than the science.
We can't picture you doing anything else. That's all of a sudden you're saying that makes me think. Picture whether you'd be a pilot or a fireman or what you'd be. So kind of transitioning into one, I'm curious when you really started to think about the field of research for wilderness, and maybe lead into number two, how did you come to be the director of the Leopold Institute? What path took you here?
Well, straight out of grad school, after interviewing for three different university professorship jobs, and they weren't in places I was particularly intrigued by, and they weren't in environments. I started really questioning whether, is this what I really want to do with my life? And kind of out of the blue, my major professor, Hal Mooney at Stanford, brought a letter in that he'd gotten from the Park Service saying that they were going to be advertising to fill a job as a basically to run the research program for a research scientist, a PhD research scientist at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. First time I knew parks had a job like that. So he said, I think this might fit your interests really well. And so I applied and was interviewed both in San Francisco and down at the park and offered the job and took it. And it all happened kind of fast near the end of my last year in grad school. So I spent, well, it was close to 21. I'd been there about 20 years. Basically, I went in as a sole body. I realized I was probably better at developing a program than I was at actually doing the science myself. And so by the time, after 20 years, I had been able to justify and hire two additional permanent full-time research-grade scientists, several support positions. We'd had a small building built by the park and put aside for us, things that they just never had before. And I had been very successful in leveraging money, both Park Service and from outside. The state of California put a lot of money into some early acid rain research in the Sierra Nevada, air pollution work funded by the Forest Service. I had been very good at successful in attracting some really top mostly academic scientists to come in and start working in the parks themselves and sending grad students there. And we built a pretty successful program that I think was fast becoming a model for other parks when, in 1993, I guess, the decision was made at the department level that all the research and scientists in Department of Interior agencies were going to be pulled out of their agencies and put into a new National Biological Survey. And this Bruce Babbitt was Secretary of the Interior, and this was his vision. And we kind of learned later that his hero was John Wesley Powell, who, besides exploring the Colorado River and a lot of the West, had created the U.S. Geological Survey. And Babbitt figured he was going to make his legacy a biological equivalent with the U.S. Biological Survey. So he actually came out to Sequoia and visited with us, and our park superintendent at the time tried to convince him why this was not a good idea. A lot of people did. The chief scientists of the Park Service in Washington, along with the heads of science in the BLM and Fish and Wildlife Service and Bureau of Indian Affairs and a couple of other minor agencies who had scientists, were all called into these planning meetings, and the Park Service person was dismissed after the first one and told not to come back because he raised too many objections as to why this wasn't a good idea for the Park Service. So they got some lower-level person to continue, and our chief scientist was completely out of all the planning and negotiations. Nobody was sure if it was really going to happen, but then it did happen. It was able to be done administratively, and within months, November of 93, it would have been, the newly elected Republican House of Representatives with Newt Gingrich as Speaker had their Contract for America, their big program, and one of the items in it was to zero out this new National Biological Survey. So everybody was just trying to figure out what the future held. Nobody really wanted it to work. Some wanted it to go away and everybody lose their jobs completely. Some wanted it to go back the way it was. And it was really a mess. And so that's when I just, for the first time ever, even thought about the idea of a different job. And when I saw this advertised for the director of this new cross-cutting interdisciplinary interagency Leopold Institute, threw my hat in the ring. At first, I found out later, I didn't hear anything for about six months, and I made an inquiry of somebody, whatever happened with that? And they said, well, it still hasn't been filled, and somebody, Bruce Kilgore, who was with the Park Service at the time, but had a Forest Service background and knew a lot of those people, made a call or two and said, well, I hadn't been considered because I was from another agency. And well, it turned out the way I should have been, the way it was advertised within the government. So I believe it was in early January of 94, I was in D.C. for a meeting, actually, and I got a phone call early one morning in my hotel room saying, I'm somebody from personnel and Forest Service, I'm offering you the job as director of the Leopold Institute, do you accept? Nobody had talked to me about the job. I really didn't know much about it. So I was able to stall for a couple months, make a trip up here, and then I really had to do some soul searching. But things weren't getting any better for the MBS. This was moving out of a research grade position. I just, a year or two earlier, had reached the GS-15 level through research grade, which I was going to be able to maintain, even though I wasn't sure how much science I would do. And I really realized my strength, I thought, was not the doing of the science as much as the facilitation and organizing. So it seemed like a really natural fit to expand my my interests and what I thought I was best at. So that's what happened. There is a couple of other sort of, maybe these would come up later, but I might as well just say them right now. There were some other ties. It seemed like it was almost fortuitous or meant to be. The Leopold family tie. Not only had Starker Leopold, one of Aldo's sons, been a family friend growing up and had a number of mutual graduate students with my father, but Luna Leopold, another son, who had once been director of the USGS, had moved to Berkeley by that time, and he and his wife had become probably my parents, one of their very best friends. Bob Lucas I knew of because I believe he got his master's degree under my father, actually. David Cole had taken classes from my dad, so I knew a lot of these names, and it just seemed like it was kind of this is really coincidental.
I want you to talk just a minute about research for wilderness, you know, in that. You talked about, you know, the agencies and moving here, and you came up here to learn more about it. So, you know, you started thinking about managing research in wilderness. That seems different than what you're doing at Sequoia, or was it?
I guess I didn't view it as very different, because research for the parks, the work we were doing there was always... Well, it was mostly focused on management issues, and at that time, in the 80s and into the 90s, I think the general feeling within the parks was that they were the closest to what wilderness was supposed to be prior to the Wilderness Act, at least. And you know, to tell you the truth, the passing. When Sequoia and Kings Canyon were designated as wilderness, not in the original bill, but in the 80s, it didn't even cause a ripple, because I don't think people fully understood what the Wilderness Act meant, and they felt like they were already doing most of that. I mean, they probably were doing most of it. So I think doing research for these large protected natural areas was natural for me.
Okay. So when you came here, when you first started as director, How did you prioritize the work at Leopold Institute? How did you pick either wilderness-related or administrative-related? I guess I was open to either one. You know, what came to your mind as the big topics, you know, the first 3 or 4 or 5 years? What did you focus on? How did you
decide? My recollection is that I relied pretty heavily on the staff that was here, because I felt that was... I recognized that everybody here had a really strong reputation in the areas they worked in. It was a small staff, so it was very difficult to address all the different needs that we knew were out there. So rather than try to, I didn't try to redirect the scientists that were here into other areas necessarily. But at the same time, I think I also realized very quickly that the future and success of the Institute was really dependent on the other agencies who were our cooperators. Because in the first 6 months or year, and I had had a meeting with Congressman Vento, who had been a big pusher of this, and his staff people, Jim Bradley in particular, it was clear this was to be not just a Forest Service effort, but the other three wilderness management agencies were going to be part of it. And, of course, the new NBS, the science wing of Interior, created a sort of a ripple that hadn't been envisioned when the Institute was first created. So that was a big part of it, too, was to try to be responsive and work with those other agencies, including the Forest Service, to show that we were responsive to what they saw their biggest needs in wilderness were. Now, I mean, that leads into the long story of frustration of trying to deal with those agencies at the higher levels, a lot of whom I don't think really appreciated what their responsibilities were with wilderness, or maybe in some cases didn't even care about them very much. So that ended up being a huge part of my focus for many, many years, was just the interagent trying to get the other agencies more involved. At one point, the Park Service called and was offered to send us somebody, a named person. Well, I knew it was somebody we didn't want, and they were just basically trying to place that person, and I said no. And then later, there was a similar offer to move their National Wilderness Coordinator. The first person had actually been a park superintendent several places, but he wasn't a scientist. So it was kind of fending off. It was like I at times felt they viewed us as a dumping place for some of their people. But at the same time, we still had this vision that we would get money from them, and we did get some project money, but we never got the base support. But I will say I spent many, many trips to Washington talking to an ever-changing group of what they called the Wilderness Policy Council, the head wilderness people from each of those five agencies, trying to explain to them why this was in their interests and what the intent was. And so I definitely spent more sleepless nights and more time on that than I did on science. And then I mostly just tried to facilitate the existing staff to keep their work going, but also to try to be at least somewhat responsive to the agency needs.
That's certainly what I imagined. The administrative things we're in a new situation with the Institute, and you were coming in with knowledge from a different program too, organization. So that was, I would think, would have been real beneficial to us.
The other thing that happened that very first year, just 6 months or so after I was here, it was a year plus later, was when what had happened? Vento lost his chairmanship, basically, and wasn't in a position to make anything happen. I guess that was in 94. Anyway,
the 30th anniversary conference, I remember a lot of sad faces down there, Vento included. He just sat on a table and talked to us with his head down.
I can't do much about it, he said. We're not in charge anymore. And it was like my view of how at the agency higher top levels reaction to this was, whew, now we don't have to do that.
Yeah. Well, over your lengthy time as director, we had the question here, what factors influence the choices about wilderness topics to prioritize? I was wondering if you'd maybe give an example of something, how you influenced the topics we studied. When you first came in, you certainly facilitated the scientists, kept things moving, worked on administrative. Talk about, you know, over time, how you influenced the topics studied and some indicators of success you feel.
Well, I don't know how much influence I really had. I was certainly influenced by, I had increasingly through my career sensed the importance of the human dimension of things. So coming here and having Alan here, and primarily Alan, but some of his collaborators, and to some extent maybe David Cole, focusing more on the human aspect really just struck me as, well, this is really critical. We need to keep this going. All of the what I had viewed as biological or questions really ultimately had a human component to them, whether they were fire or wildlife or whatever. In terms of research topics at the Institute, the two new areas, I guess, that came about after I got here, were fire and I guess I would say wildlife, and they really came about in different ways. The fire program, my recollection, and this may not be the recollection of Alan and David and others, was that in some of our prioritization meetings and listening to what the agencies had to say, fire was a topic that came up continually. And while there were fire research programs in the other agencies and in the Forest Service, there was a wilderness component to it that we felt was being ignored. I did have personal background in that area from my Sierra Nevada days. I think the whole staff was interested in it, maybe David a little less than the others. So we were, I don't recall exactly how the first money came about, but talking with Peter kind of took the lead on that area, working with me, and we brought Carol Miller in initially, who I had again worked with in the Sierra, and knew she had a personality and some expertise that I thought might fit in pretty well. She didn't come out of really a wilderness background at all, but I had a hunch that wasn't going to be a major issue for her to get her on board. And so we brought her in first, I believe, in a term appointment, and eventually got her into a permanent one, and that's just sort of flourished. She's developed working relationships with a lot of other people, both within the Forest Service, the other agencies, and in academia. The other would have been in that whole fire program is, I'm sure, is the biggest funded program at the Institute now, partly because, not because it's necessarily the biggest wilderness issue, but because of external factors that fire has just become a major issue, eating up all of the agencies' budgets. And the other, the wildlife one, was a little bit different story. In our negotiations with, our continuing negotiations with the National Biological Survey, which later got incorporated into the U.S. Geological Survey as the Biological Resources Branch, and trying to, you know, you guys have the science responsibilities for Interior, for the science responsibility, that includes wilderness. And so Steve Korn, who had been in Fort Collins at some point, was put forward to us as, yeah, we would like to send him up there to represent us. I mean, he had his own interests in mostly in declining amphibian populations, which was fine. That fit into, and a lot of his work had been in national parks and I believe in a few Fish and Wildlife Service and Forest Service areas. So it wasn't a bad fit. Again, he didn't come in with any background or, not even sure, very much interest in wilderness per se, but and I don't think that work ever got very well integrated into the rest of the Institute. But you know, most of the work our different scientists did wasn't integrated very well with others here. Most of them had their own external collaboration groups.
As an indicator of success, Carol's still here, and Steve stayed till he retired, and they certainly built careers on those topics.
And young scientists are now here sort of Carol's got a second one, and Sean and Blake has taken basically the role Steve played. So
they're continuing as important topics for the Leopold Institute. What about, you know, I also had the question of what determined the places the scientists at the Leopold Institute decided to study? Were you ever involved in those decisions, or how do you think, you know, I'm a scientist here, and you know, as you watched us work, did you try to guide us towards places? You know, topics is one thing, places seems to be another. And people often ask us how we decide. You know, what? How do you think we decided? Or what role did you play in those?
For the most part, I think it was just the role I would play was just, in most cases, was questioning, reviewing and questioning, you know, why do you want to do this work where you're doing it? I think there was a conscious effort to try to spread our work into some geographic areas that we had not worked in the past. But, you know, so often the money came with specific areas in mind, or regions at least. So to some extent we had some freedom, but not complete. There was an effort made, and Peter Landris took the lead on this and actually hosted a couple of workshops, one in the south, I remember. I think that was Peter, and one in the southwest deserts, trying to bring together wilderness managers and mostly managers, a few scientists, I believe, to talk about what their wilderness needs are that science and the Institute might be able to help with. I'm not really sure very much came out of those, specifically out of those workshops. Seems like Alan started working a little more in the South after that, but he always had an interest in the South.
I was going to say, you and I kind of ventured off into Alaska. That was a pretty big issue, and you certainly supported that and were part of the decision. You know, is that a good idea? I mean, we've worked a lot of places in Alaska. We've developed a lot of knowledge we didn't have before, but I'm wondering how, then we kind of went on at some point in time.
You know, there were so many needs in so many places that I thought it was really hard to prioritize. You know, I thought it was important to keep us an appearance of working throughout the country, in different parts of the country, but that had to be tempered to some extent to where the local interest was and where the dollar support was. I don't recall a whole lot of projects that came in here where we were free to go do the work wherever we wanted. Now, in some cases, we may have applied for that money to work in Alaska or in certain places. I think on the whole, we did a pretty good job of spreading out between the boundary waters and the southeast, and you know, maybe we were weak in the northeast, but again, it was balancing the expertise we had here and the funding sources and the interests of the agencies we were trying to be responsive to. And in some cases it would be a local wilderness manager who would come to us that had the drive and the interest that would get our attention, because if without local support, a lot of the projects we did wouldn't have gone very well. So
one of our scientists used to suggest that I was a mile wide and inch deep, and he wanted to be an inch wide and a mile deep. Did you ever think about that? You know, did you influence us in trying to keep tighter or to explore more?
Well, I think that was a continual challenge. Mm-hmm. We were so thin in terms of staff that you couldn't, to become an expert in some topic, you needed to spend most of your time on that, and it was very hard to broaden out, either discipline-wise, topically, or geographically. So, yeah, I think that was a constant struggle we had here, and I think as I would talk with the scientists about what they wanted to work on, what they might work on, that was certainly something we thought about. But when you only have four or five core scientists to deal with the wide breadth of issues that potentially need to be addressed, I didn't feel we could really afford to have four or five very focused deep scientists, using your terminology, that weren't broad. So yeah, I think I really encouraged breadth, and I think we had it for the most part.
I agree. I think you felt that. Yeah, it felt like the early days of wilderness science. You know, they had a few questions. Bob even said, we started out with a few of us with a few questions we thought we'd answer fairly quick.
Yeah.
And, you know, they, you know, it seemed kind of narrow, you know, pretty specific. We just kept mm-hmm. getting more and more broad. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know where we are today on that. It feels like a transition. Let's go on. You know, who do you feel gave you the greatest support as director of the Leopold Institute? A couple of clarifying. I said, who cared the most about your success and support and the success of the Institute? And who did you most enjoy collaborating with? I'd like to think about, you know, how you reacted to either external or internal influences on you as director of the Leopold Institute.
I think the greatest support came internally from the staff here, who especially the staff that carried over from the previous work unit, they wanted to see this work. Other than a few individuals, I really didn't sense the same support or desire to make sure we were successful from the national levels of any of the agencies, including the Forest Service or of the Rocky Mountain Research Station. When we got, you know, put under, initially we were just administratively under them but reported to the Washington office. I never really sensed the interest in us being successful seemed to be fleeting. In the sense, when we would sit, they would visit, or I would sit down with them, the interest was there, but then nothing would happen. So that was a very discouraging reality check. Unfortunately, in terms of collaborating, you know, I tried not to play favorites within the Institute. I wasn't doing really science per se. The writing I continued to do tended to be sort of big overview issues. So my science collaboration, really, what was most memorable about that was people outside the agencies, for the most part. Some of the university people, some of whom we got to come here, or like Tom Swetnam came up from Arizona, people like Lisa Gromlich or Norm Christensen, Greg Applett with Wilderness Society, who we got involved in some issues, or got them to come to some conferences and play some keynote roles. I mean, to me, those were much more rewarding collaborations than trying to work with the bureaucrats, the administrators within the agencies, who had a lot of other things on their mind as well, and you know, had questionable commitment. Maybe I think they just hoped we would succeed, but.
Yeah, great. That's what I was looking for. I appreciate that. Just name some of those people that, yeah, makes me smile. You know, good relationships we had with a lot of good scholars and.
Well, and those were the names of people that I really interacted with most. But each of the scientists here had their own group. Alan, in particular, I think, had some really strong collaborators that really appreciated the time he put in. I think, and I guess I should say, I think those people also really cared about the success of the Institute.
Yeah.
David tended to work a little bit on his own more, but there were some cases, and the Beyond Naturalness workshops he pulled together, or in the book that came out of that he and Laurie Young did, I think were a good example where he had some really good collaborations. Peter's collaborations tended to be more with managers than scientists, I would say. But and Carol has collaborated pretty widely with both. I think we never would have made it very far at all here at ALRI if we hadn't had the external collaborations.
Yeah. The mission of Leopold Institute within overall Forest Service research, you know, think about just within the Forest Service. Mm-hmm. And in science generally, but I'm interested in you explaining to me how unique our mission was, or whether you think it's unique.
I think many of the components of what we did were not particularly unique. It was the efforts and ability to integrate that work into the bigger overriding question of that wilderness brought to the table. So you could be an expert in any number of topics, and that's what I think most scientists are, but to try to apply those to this administrative classification of wilderness and to integrate your work with other relevant work so it is applicable to the stewardship decisions that had to be made. To me, that's what was unique. The cross-cutting, taking individual expertise and topics and trying to apply that to this bigger picture idea. I'm not sure there's very many other examples where that would hold in agency research. So I guess that, to me, that was the uniqueness of it, trying to bring different areas of expertise, cross-cutting themes and disciplines together to work in common towards some common goals.
So within the Forest Service, that was unique. Does it make you think of anything else in science? Do you think other people deal with that complexity or that uniqueness? Anything? You ever run into anyone out there that was doing something real similar to you? You felt like, or
no, to some extent, the Park Service research programs in the late 70s, 80s, early 90s was closer to that than Forest Service research. I think one of the eye openers for me was coming into the Forest Service and realizing that these work units were really very discipline based, whereas in the Park Service, where there was only one or two or three or four scientists in a park, everybody, for the most part, was dealing with these bigger questions and with multiple questions at once. Outside of the agencies, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service, I think, was at the other extreme. The scientists I got to know that came out of that agency mostly were focused on very narrow questions, whether it was a certain bird disease or a fisheries disease. They did not look at the broader ecological interrelationships much, and they all certainly didn't bring in the human aspects of it. You know, I think it's a kind of unique situation. I think there are examples of small groups of scientists that work together in terms of universities or between universities. I'm not sure the way science is organized in this country facilitates that very well, the broad, what I would call ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, I think that's consistent internationally, too. You know, I think that's why we're kind of novel, you know, why mm-hmm. I do a lot of international mm-hmm. work, and you have, too, because we're doing something other people don't quite understand.
Yeah.
We've had people come here from Denmark, from UFRO, trying to figure out, you know, how we work at interagency. You know, how does mm-hmm. that work, you know? Mm-hmm. And you're dealing with maybe less of a biophysical resource and more of a sociocultural defined thing sometimes, you know, and that's intriguing to them. So there's, you know, I hadn't thought about it before just right now, but if I was trying to answer your question, all of a sudden mm-hmm. I went international, and boy, we're a novelty. You know, we're unusual. They can't quite figure this out sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how you think science at the Leopold Institute during your time as director related or was really different from early wilderness-related research prior to your arrival. And I ask you that some because we've interviewed people earlier than you in our program. You're filling a big part of the history of the Leopold Institute. How did those relate, you know, what was happening before we became an institute and what was happening as an institute interagency with you as director?
Well, I guess my impression, and I wasn't here to see it firsthand, was that prior to the Institute, the Wilderness Research Work Unit, the Forest Service, which was the prime, other than a few individuals scattered around, were the only people I'm aware of that were really focusing on wilderness questions, really was focused primarily on the human use component. Both the impacts of use, allocation of use, and perceptions of users. And clearly the founding documents for the Institute articulated taking those, broadening those out to considerably broader ecological, with some questions, with some, you know, ecosystem biology, ecology components. And I guess that would be, so while we continued to do the kind of work that had been done before, I guess, you know, I think it was the expansion beyond those traditional recreation users and impact studies that was the big difference into more ecological questions, values questions, maybe some economics even.
Well, that leads really well in the next question. As we became more diverse in agencies we represented, the disciplines we represented, can you evaluate the extent of the contribution of a collaborative, congenial atmosphere of work at Leopold Institute? You know, was that easier? Was it difficult? Did you have to manage us a lot? Or how did you feel about our atmosphere?
I thought it was difficult. I mean, I thought really the three of you that were here when I came, we're all pretty focused on your own interests, and I had a hard time getting people to sit down and interact, and really at some point I kind of gave up in trying to force collaboration in terms of true collaboration. Some of that was personality driven, some of it was just, I mean, I think being sort of entrenchment and knowing that you were appreciated and recognized for what you had been doing and not wanting to change from that too much. I decided not too many years into my tenure here that I was probably better off just facilitating each of you with your own networks of collaborators, and to focus on within Institute collaboration more on trying to identify and see if we could reach agreement on priorities and things that might not even be in all cases ones that people here would be doing, but. So, yeah, I thought it was there wasn't hostility. I thought there was resistance, I guess.
Was it competitive?
I don't think I sense the competitiveness to it very much.
I don't either. It feels like there is some sense that we could have been more cooperative, but we didn't find a way to do it. But it, like you said, it wasn't hostile. It wasn't real competitive. We were kind of operating our own
world. You know, I think all of you... But maybe David more than any were really had your vision of what the right way to do things were. And he in particular, and I can remember instance with both you, Alan, and with Peter, where I would try to bring you together, and he just wasn't. He knew what he wanted done, and you know,
strong personality.
Yeah,
that way, for sure.
And he was very much appreciated for what he did in the field, so it was not worth my effort to really try to force a change there.
It's hard for those of us who know his science accomplishments and then get in a conversation with someone that might be critical of that, you know, strong personality, to where you end up defending that, you know, or defending him because of the quality of the science he produces. Mm-hmm. But yet, more collegiality. I know he certainly valued that in early stages. I just have to say to you that when it was just him and me, it was difficult. When Peter came, it really helped a lot, because then you could focus. Mm-hmm. Having three people versus two really became more collaborative. It's hard to describe. And then as we grew more, you know, you're handling a larger and larger group of people with more discipline diversity and topics, and I think it would be hard to maintain that collegiality that maybe the early days of the Institute or the Research Work Unit, very small number of people, everybody focused on LAC or everybody focused on, you know, we never had that, you know, very much.
Well, I don't think there are very many examples out there where groups have been very successful in doing that. It's a tall order.
Yeah, you diversify and grow, you know, and try to make progress. All those things, we became more and more that. If we were an inch wide and a mile deep, we would have been more collegial and more collaborative probably. I was interested in you talking to us about your role in the science community. Not necessarily just the wilderness science community, but beyond your duties at the Leopold Institute or as an extension of them, you know, what did you perceive your role or contribution to the larger science community to be? I perceive you did a lot and you really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I was pretty involved throughout my career with professional societies, and I think I saw my role being, especially with, well, the Ecological Society of America was one I had held some positions in, served as an editor, the longest running editor for their journal Ecological Management, still, that there's ever been. But it was to, I organized a number of workshops, theme sessions at their major conferences and some regional conferences, was to bring the interests and importance needs of initially parks, but really big protected natural landscapes is really the way to talk about it, to the bigger science communities, to the ecological community, many of those conferences would be graduate students or that were in fairly narrow disciplinary, were studying fairly narrow disciplinary topics and were looking for ways to make their work more relevant outside, or once they moved on into new jobs. So I really felt I had a role I could play in bringing the bigger view of the importance of these kinds of management issues of these big protected areas to the science community. I guess the other major group I've been involved with was the George Wright Society, where it sort of grew out of some early Park Service science conferences into what now is a much broader interdisciplinary, way beyond the Park Service, a lot more academia, more international participation at their biennial conferences, of which I've chaired several. I've been on their board of directors. This year we'll be wrapping up my second six-year tenure there, so it will have been a total of 12 years. And again, it was more trying to maybe bring the scientists and the managers together. That was what I liked so much about those conferences. They were very different than the Ecological Society, where you basically had all scientists, students, and more senior scientists would get together. Here with George Wright, it was everybody from field managers to park superintendents to Washington office people to scientists both inside and outside the agencies. So those were probably my two primary involvements. Kept me pretty busy and still do to some extent, although the George Wright will be winding down now. And I've not been very involved with the ESA, Ecological Society, since I retired.
Okay. Last question we have on the list is, I was curious to try to get you to talk a little bit about retirement. You know, I'm curious about things like whether wilderness and science are part of your identity, and if so, how? What are your priorities in retirement? Just anything, you know, you think about or want to talk about so that we know what it's like when you leave here.
Oh, yeah, thinking ahead to what it might be like when you leave. I would say wilderness, parks, science, none of those are as prominent in my life as I thought they would continue to be when I first retired. I thought I would stay more engaged. I know some people that have, and others that tell exactly the same story I do, including talking to David Cole not too long ago, who was going to really continue to stay engaged. And he and I have continued with one project that's about up now. But I think we both have, since he's, thought we'd be more involved. And, you know, in my case, it's because there's a lot more to keep me busy, mostly on our 20-some acres that I'm outside working a lot and just getting out and recreating, skiing, whatever. But I guess I've also sensed there's a certain, to a certain extent, you're kind of forgotten faster than I thought I would be by the people I used to work with. And, you know, there was several years ago, there was a big thing on campus that I didn't even know about till after I read about it in the paper, I thought I should have been invited to, and I definitely would have come to. But I find the same thing with the parks, which I stayed involved with Sequoia and Kings Canyon up. Well, I still am to some extent, but now there's been enough staff turnover down there that those people also are. It's a new generation, and now that we've just rediscovered some important raw data sets that that they should want, the two people most important to those in the past that those were most important to aren't there anymore, and I'm not sure that the people there now even realize. So David and I had been working on all this old campsite inventory data from this late 70s. We decided one of us or both of us need to somehow figure a trip down there to sit down once they've got people in place and go over it. Up until maybe this past 6 months, I don't think I had a single day since I retired, which is, it's been a long time. It's been 5 years now. It's hard to believe. What am I going to do today? A couple times I've had that thought in the last 6 months, I'd say. But mostly it's because there were things I knew I needed to do that I didn't want to do. I still have a lot of files, mostly from my earlier career at the Park Service when I was doing science, and I hoarded a bunch of historical documents that I still have here that I am working through.
You have a role model in retirement? Like when you retire, did you go, I don't want to be like that person. I really want to be like that person.
I really don't.
Any role model?
And I don't, I still am pretty active. We still do a fair number of things with a number of other local retirees. I sort of sense I might be more involved than any of them are in terms of staying in touch, even as little as I do. I mean, we do journeys with the Carlsons and Pat and Greg Jones and Zimmerman's. And Arno's. Steve could be a role. Steve Arno could be a role model. He's written several books since he retired.
He's still an expert.
Yeah.
All right. Well, great. Are there any other questions or things you wrote down that you wanted to talk about? Or
no, not really.
We sure appreciate you doing the interview and to take this opportunity to thank you for your contribution to Leopold Institute. So what years do you think that was, from 94 until
May of 94 till January of 2010?
2010. And you were director that whole time. Great.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Okay.